You can order a nip from Sal's, and if you ask politely, the Winnipeg waitstaff will give you a complimentary tuck. They figure that since you're ingesting 900 calories, you're good for a few pounds savagely lacerated off your blubber with an unsanitized knife. But then, I'm not an expert on such matters. Guy Madden, on the other hand, is. Okay, so I am here with Guy Madden, who is the writer and director of My Winnipeg, and now also the author of My Winnipeg. Guy, how are you doing?
I'm great. Thanks for having me on the show.
Thanks for being here. I must ask, you've lived in Winnipeg your entire life, and I'm curious if that makes you an automatic expert about what Winnipeg is, whether actually chronicling the Winnipeg experience, as you have done so in both the film and the book, to degrees of I suppose, stretching the veracity of what is actually there. Where does expertise lie in this? Would you identify yourself in this category of labels I'm throwing at you?
I am an expert, but I think... And I'm an expert on the subject of both the movie and now the book. But the subject isn't just my hometown or everyone's hometown. It's, I guess, alas, I wish it weren't so. I'm an expert on my own confused feelings. I'm not saying I know what to make of them, but I guess know how they feel more than anyone else. And when the original movie, My Winnipeg, was commissioned, I was told by the executive producer to make it a personal portrait of Winnipeg, almost a propaganda piece or an attempted enchantment. He just said that he wanted to be enchanted by the movie. Don't show me the frozen hellhole everyone thinks Winnipeg is, or that everyone knows Winnipeg is, I think is what he said. So I realized I wasn't going to have to stray from my methods in an attempt to enchant people, that I'd always believe there's a kind of a truth about things that lurks in your feelings about them, that's a different kind of truth, but is just as true as cold hard facts. You know, what difference does it make what the population is or the industrial base of a city if that has nothing to do with your experience of it? So, it doesn't really matter. All that stuff doesn't matter when people are thinking of their homes either. You know, you're going for qualities that aren't quantifiable.
But sure, but if you wanted to avoid portraying Winnipeg as a hellhole, you still have some rather terrible things happen. For example, there's, you know, demolition is a growth industry applied to both the Clifford's department store as well as the arena. So this is not exactly the most pleasant of feelings. It's certainly funny, but it's also rather terrifying and hellish at the same time. And so I'm wondering if there's a certain enchantment you feel with hellish depictions of architecture crumbling down that you weren't even able to film properly.
Yeah. No, maybe an apocalyptic enchantment or an Icelandic enchantment. I come from an Icelandic heritage, and I grew up listening to retellings of, I never read them myself, retellings of Icelandic sagas or just accounts of what it was like to be an Icelandic immigrant in the 19th century in Canada. And those were bleak times. The accumulation of tragedy piled so high it became hilarious. It just became so distant and removed and storybook-like, even though it was true, that it seemed to take on aspects of hilarity. It was... I say aspects of, you know, I wasn't exactly laughing at smallpox plagues and things like that, but they did have, like, I don't know, just so many things happened. The Icelandic relatives I grew up with just had a way of telling their own life stories that reminded me of ancient sagas. They have the same kind of distance, the same kind of grotesque atrocities happened to them, and they dealt out a few themselves, and things are just hard. Those were hard times, and they just took on a kind of a Flannery O'Connor like or Ibsen like I don't know, there's just something instantly mythic and gothic and stark and wonderful about my own family's stories too. So it was very easy just to make my city feel like one of these things, for better or worse.
Well, this is interesting. There's a couple of questions that come from this last answer that make me curious. One, this notion of proprietary
proprietary feeling to one's topography or one's location. That is always an interesting scenario. I mean, if I were to say my New York, you would look at me and declare me the world's ultimate narcissist. And yet, when you say my Winnipeg, you can get away with that. And I think you have a little bit of an advantage being in Winnipeg and being able to say that. I really wish I could say my New York, but I just would be looked at as if I had the biggest head in the world.
That's, well, so many people have done New York, too. I've got the advantage of of just being among a small handful of artists that are doing it. The artist, the now New York-based artist, Marcel Zama from Winnipeg, has been doing Winnipeg quite a bit. I was out for drinks with him last night, and we were chatting about how we're doing our little bit to keep Winnipeg on the map. But things happen there on their own, and they're always kind of remote outpost kind of things, and stark and grisly things, and someone murdered by a puck, and or Susan Sarandon's jewel theft turned into a disembowelment, and a bus riding decapitation. And most recently, I just returned to Winnipeg for a couple days, and the first story I read in the paper was about a gang of teenage girls that roam the streets and hack with a hatchet the purse strings of women walking around near them. And one of them was one purse snatching was foiled by the purse holder flinging a cup of molten hot Tim Hortons coffee in the assailant's face. I don't know, there's just this kind of stuff going on all the time, and obviously it's not unique to Winnipeg, but it seems like the headlines are being written by a 19th century translator of Brothers Grimm stories half the time.
Well, perhaps some of these people who commit these crimes are doing so to alleviate the intense indoorsdom of being in Winnipeg.
Yeah,
for
and they're
six
trying
months
to,
of the year, you know?
Exactly. They're cabin fever. Yeah, it's that time of year. And they're just writing their own legends.
Yeah.
Canadians don't really talk about their history. They don't really boil down legends and folk tales the way every other country in the world does, possibly because we've been dwarfed so badly, rattled so badly by our presence right next to America. But
I'm sorry about that.
No. It's kind
of
good.
You don't deserve it. There's a lot of great things that come out of
Canada.
No.
Whatever. My temperament is part of that whole thing, and I kind of like it. I kind of like feeling like, when you roll over, I should look out. And
but actually, like, I will give you something, in fact, about both the book and the film that is an advantage over America. You have a disclaimer in this book. The film, My Winnipeg, deliberately blurs the line between fact and fiction. No attempt has been made to distinguish the two, and so there may be significant factual errors in the script, narrative, and essays. Please don't read this book as historical truth. We can't do that in America because, we have this whole James Fry mentality where everything that is put into memoir form must therefore be true. Every film that we see that is depicting in even the bare bones idea of an event is based on a true story. We don't have the liberating quality that you have sometimes to mess around with fact and fiction and just outright prevarications, which you have done quite well in both.
Yeah,
the
the movie came with no such disclaimer, and it was kind of nice because I just spoke an uninhibited truth about my feelings about Winnipeg, my family, and it was the movie was way more true, literally, with its facts than people know. But I guess the disclaimer is necessary or something, just because we didn't feel like vetting everything. But I'd say the book's even more true. It's make up anything, but I just didn't feel like double checking anything. So you found the disclaimer. It's sort of hidden amongst all the other copyright
materials. Well, the design of the book essentially causes one to look through all the various texts. And I think it was a little bit of a treasure hunt that led to the disclaimer. And the disclaimer, of course, had the advantage of being at the beginning of the book, which, of course, was one of the first things I read. So
I should have maybe made not just a double, but a triple and octuple negative in the disclaimer. So that no one would ever be able to figure out what
I meant. Or you could have scattered the disclaimer over the course of the book with little
footnotes, word at a time.
But actually, I want to clarify a couple of things in the book. You insist in this book that the naked lap does not belong to your ex-girlfriend, Aaron Hirschberg. So to set the matter straight, who then does the naked lap belong to?
I can't remember her name. I just hire. There's sort of, you know, I've got a number of nude models on speed dial that
whoever calls
just come
first.
Over. Yeah, yeah. So I just put out. I put out a call for a naked lap.
Wow, that's almost easier in Winnipeg to get a nude model than it is here in Manhattan.
Yeah, I don't know what it's like. I've never tried here. In Manhattan.
I don't know. So but, I hear. So I hear.
But it was cheap. It was, you know, she was in and out in a hurry. I just needed a few quick shots, so I had a little chair with a black backdrop set on it and a light meter. Way to go! And she came in.
Took 5 minutes.
Pulled her pants down. It's 2 minutes.
Two minutes.
I did a few shots.
So you had like essentially 3 little 2-second shots that you captured in 2 minutes.
That's
a really,
like that.
You know, really very. Well, good use of your budget, I would say.
I've always tried to be thoughtful to performers. The first impression I ever got of when I visited a movie set was how dull it was and how slow moving it was. Anyone of your listeners who visit a movie set know the same thing. You know, it just crawls along. So I could never do that to people. So I always try to have things set up and ready to go by the time they show up. Not the other way around, where someone shows up and then commences waiting for hours and hours and hours and then maybe doesn't even get in or anything. So
yeah.
I just like to have them come in, pull their pants down, leave.
Yeah, got it. Well, also, I would say that the editing of your films has increased over the course of the years. And in fact, I would argue has made your films possibly more interesting. And probably from around 99 or 2000, you immediately started doing, you know, really like quick half-second cuts and the like, this almost Eisenstein kind of feel. And I'm curious as to why you went from away from the rather long shots that you see in Twilight of the Ice Nymphs and even Archangel to this real sped-up quality that makes your films. And also, another question I have also likewise of your use of titles, which is reminiscent of Godard and his obsession with titles. But how did this tremendous shift come about? It was after the Mountain film period, I would say.
Yeah, it was. I like audiences being involved in the movies. In my earliest movies, I was happy with the way they turned out. Gimli Hospital, Archangel, Careful. They always just seemed a bit too leisurely for me. And while the walkout ratios improved with each outing, they were still too high for my liking. I do feel, you know, most people assume I'm some kind of stubborn, willful artiste who doesn't give a hang about the walkout ratios or even loves them, but they kind of hurt a little bit, or at least filled me with determination to engage an audience a bit better. Twilight of the Ice Nymphs was my worst film at engaging audiences, and the shots were very long. It was just a bunch of things out of my control. I had switched to 35mm. I didn't know how to move the camera as much. And I don't know, I just didn't have a great working relationship with everyone on the movie. And so I couldn't get that portability and some energy into it. But already with the short films I had been making before that, I had liberated the camera from the tripod and was moving it around a lot. And then when I made Heart of the World in 2000, I was determined to make something pretty kinetic. And it's been pretty kinetic ever since.
Yeah.
It's the same melodramas, but I just ditched the tableau. I used to just get a great kick out of just seeing tableaus overstaying their welcome on the screen and kind of just really getting musty. I wanted people to smell the mildew in the tableaus, but I did enough of that, and it's time to move along. And it feels good now seeing that everyone stays in their seats.
Yeah. But why should you even care about the walkout rate or what the audience experiences if you are putting down rather distinct images and rather specific parochial images, particularly with this autobiographical phase of your career? It would seem to me that you should kind of have moved beyond this point. Then again, I say to myself, well, he had like Shelley Duvall and all these Alice Krieg and Twilight of the Ice Nymphs. He has Isabella Rossellini and the saddest music in the world. So what of this great conundrum?
I don't know. I guess when I started adding live elements to my shows in the movie Brand Upon the Brain, it was often presented with live music, live sound effects, which are really fun to watch being produced. A live narration, live singing, and I just felt the adrenaline high at the end of each evening of being a showman for once. And then I realized that this was just an extension, not the flip side, but an extension of what I'd always wanted to be. I'd always wanted to enchant large numbers of people. I don't necessarily mean, $400 million worth of box office, but just a room, the people that do show up, I want to enchant them, so it matters to me. I'm kind of a populist, just displaced maybe in time, but I want to give people access into what intoxicates me, and I'm getting a little bit better at it.
Jay Hoberman once described you as the most accessible of avant-garde filmmakers. I'm not sure if you're aware of that.
Or the most avant-garde of the mainstream filmmakers. He couldn't decide.
You do read your own press.
I read Jim Hoberman. I read Jim Hoberman all the time. I love him, and I read Rosenbaum, and there's a couple others that I read, and especially the New York people. I'll read maybe the Village Voice. Not so much anymore, just on principle, ever since Dennis Lim left. But I don't read my own press other than that. It's just too horrible. Even the favorable press somehow feels wrong, fills me with Lutheran shame and guilt.
Even the New York people are prone to do that too,
Is that right?
Yeah. They sometimes kind of miss the boat on your films, I would say,
Yeah.
Based off of my IMDb casual researching.
I learned long ago not to read anything written on IMDb, like in the reviews section. I'll check IMDb for facts all the time, but comments. I don't mean...
Oh, no, I'm talking about like the links off of the external reviews. That's what I'm saying, yeah.
Yeah, no reviews of my stuff or of any stuff, unless I just need a kind of a plot summary from something, but the sorry grammar and the... And the really lousy use of the first person singular all the time in the reviews. I, for one, if you like this sort of thing, you will too. And, I don't know, it's just so sad. But, why pick on the poor basement boys who are using up space on
you're thumbing your nose
IMDb.
Up at the user comments? Because I was talking about the external reviews, but I guess these people are also your champions sometimes.
I know, that's what depresses me. But no, they're well-meaning and a lot of time, I don't know. No, I don't read them, so I don't know. I've only read like 10 of them. I think I spent one night where I just got so masochistically drawn into the reviews like quicksand, and I couldn't get out of them, and it just left me feeling so horrible.
Why what caused
well you it? Know you've got to do an ego search now and then, and I just didn't realize how many people hated me, but then even the people that supposedly loved me seemed it was hard to tell them apart from the people that hated me.
Yeah.
And I don't know. It's just not that. It's especially when you're doing these autobiographical films, there's already, you can make yourself sick of yourself. And then you realize how sick of you some other people are too. You don't really need to read that.
You've indicated in a number of interviews that you often make a film so that you can get rid of an obsession. But here you can't get rid of this obsession when you have a character named Guy Madden in a number of your films.
I'm ready to get rid of myself.
Yeah. So I guess this is kind of this is a greater dilemma because it's not a particular topic like a mountain film. It's you and you have to live with yourself. So
yeah, well, you kind of find out what the true subject of your film was when you find out later what it was that you can no longer stand. So in my Winnipeg, I thought my obsession was my hometown of Winnipeg, but it really was something similar to that, but it was actually the question of whether I should continue to live there or whether I should move or not, that I guess I was really getting at for myself with the movie. And I cured myself of that question, and it seems kind of irrelevant now. I'm lucky I have a teaching job at the University of Manitoba in Winnipeg where I I teach one semester a year, and then I travel a lot as a filmmaker. So, and I have an apartment in Toronto near my daughter and granddaughter. And so it doesn't really, it's not a burning issue, I realized after exhausting myself questioning this thing over and over again during the course of the making of the movie and writing this book. I realize that I can continue to live there, and I can continue to live somewhere else and travel a bit, and it doesn't really matter one way or the other. So I kind of, you kind of resolve all the obsessions, either cure yourself of them or just render them irrelevant by just beating on them for so long during the long process of making a movie.
Darcy Fair has played Guy Madden in both Cowards Bend the Knees,
yeah,
and of course in My Winnipeg. And
right.
So I'm curious, he's the only actor who has played Guy Madden twice.
Right.
Why him above all other actors for Guy Madden twice? Two different permutations of Guy Madden, but nevertheless, it is important, I think.
Well, he's the Winnipeg-based Guy Madden performer. I shot Brand Upon the Brain in Seattle, and so I had to use Seattle-based. I had to use American Guy Maddens there. Yeah. It was just sort of visa issues. So, you know, Darcy couldn't come down to Seattle to because he'd be taking an American Guy Madden's job away, so he couldn't get the work permit. But I was really thrilled with the two people who played me in Seattle, Sullivan Brown and Eric Maas. So
when you get to trade between the borders, it gets a little dicey. Then your name is involved too.
Yeah, no. If we get true free trade, someone at a special event in Chicago, I had some hosts in Chicago that I felt were exploiting me at one point, and my girlfriend back home was sick, so I just flew home to Winnipeg from Chicago a day early on a scheduled visit. And so the organizer of some Guy Madden event hired an impersonator to play me. Yeah, he brought him down the aisle of a theater at the Music Box the night before the event, and this guy that, he was about 15 years younger than me and didn't have as many bald spots, and he had a nice big hank of hair that I would have had, say, circa 1994 or something like that. But then he also weighed about 50 or 60 pounds more than I did. And my host just looked at both of us as if he was looking at, you know, at a guy standing in front of a mirror, and he went, "Isn't it incredible?" You know, that sort of thing. And then, but, you know, I'm not so famous that I couldn't be fooled. So he pulled it off, apparently. I read some reviews of the event online, and no one seemed to find me missing.
So. This begs the question of why you haven't really played yourself when Guy Madden has cropped up. Would this be too much, getting behind the fourth wall, like, or crossing the fourth wall like this?
I'm a terrible actor, and I don't like looking at myself on film. It's that simple. But Darcy Fair's about 20 years younger than I am, and I really thought he should stand in for me in this movie because I'd been thinking about leaving Winnipeg for about 20 years. So it seemed to me that I would place him, because he doesn't really have that much to do in this picture. He's just nodding off to sleep and barely waking up again in these little interstitials. But I thought it would be nice to show a Guy Madden that was, you know, sort of 20 years younger and
which actually
50 pounds lighter. And
it seems very much like he's your Antoine Dwanell almost, except he's named Guy Madden.
The kid that looks like Antoine Dwanell is Sullivan Brown in Brand Upon the Brain. He actually, you know, when I met him, I just couldn't believe how much he looked like him. So we got him a little Dwanell haircut and a little pea jacket, and it was very thrilling for me.
Yeah. The notion of repeating Winnipeg multiple times, which you remark on the book, you've remarked on in interviews, this kind of repetition I must ask you about, because there's all sorts of redacted dialogue in this book.
Didn't make it in.
Yeah,
yes.
I was sort of sad because here you are complaining about the fact that Winnipeggers are known to repeat things and the like, but here you have taken dialogue that doesn't repeat anything, that just couldn't make it there for one reason or another, and it didn't make it in. So why the emphasis on repetition as opposed to sort of, I guess, fleshing out a scene, or even having perhaps like some 20-minute moment with Ann Savage?
In my original script, it was one big chunk of Ann Savage. She was going to appear toward the end of the movie, and when we were cutting the movie together, we decided to spread the Anne Savage throughout the movie. And I think it was the right decision. But as for the dialogue, sometimes I repeat things just the way I usually have two or three cameras going at once while shooting a movie. And I'll even repeat an action just from different angles, you know, show it from one angle, then another, and then move on to something else. Then maybe go back and show it a fourth time even. So it is part of that OCD quality that Winnipeggers have. And we didn't do it in this movie, but it's something I've been meaning to do, is repeat dialogue, almost like have instant replays built into the movie, like it's a sports cast.
Yeah.
You know, people like to see their favorite moments replayed, just the way, you know, your favorite sexual memories or whatever. You like to, you know, like to play them a few times until all the flavor's gone and then move on. But I think it has something to do with that in Winnipeg, the way the OCD repetitions of people conversing.
But I'm also curious how much the repetition is planned. Like, for example, the handshake in Cowards, which is rather funny because it continues and continues and continues. And then you go back to that handshake over and over again, and we see the handshake. And part of me wondered whether you had discovered how enticing and enchanting the handshake was in the course of editing, or whether your editor did this, or what happened if there was a sort of planned obsession of yours with handshakes. I mean, a handshake is a marvelous thing. We often overlook handshakes, and we shake hands all the time.
Yeah,
you know?
A lot of important moments in a movie can just go by quickly, and it's just up to film scholars to catch them later, after many, many viewings. But I say, why not just highlight these things?
And just go ahead and ram the audience over the head?
Why not? You know, I'm, remember, I'm a showman, you know. But, there's a, you know, filmmakers use other methods to ram audience. You know, sometimes music scores a moment or something. So there's just other ways of magnifying a moment or uninhibiting a moment so that people notice it a bit more. One thing my editor and I discovered around the time of making Cowards Bend the Knee in 2002 is that just by watching rushes, we'd fast forward through them and then rewind and then looking for a shot, and we'd have to go backwards and forwards as we closed in on it, and then finally slow down the images until we found the exact frame we wanted. And we found that by doing that, you kind of fetishized the moment that you were looking for. You know, you'd skip ahead to it and then even go past it, and then going backwards, you'd skip past it again, and then going forward, skip past it, but not quite so far, and then getting back to it, and then slowly rocking back and forth on it. We realized that the image took on qualities that really seemed to be rocked like a precious little baby or something just really worth staring at for a while. And it was kind of nice. And it was a nice facsimile for the way memory works for me, you know, just speeding too quickly towards something then slowing down to savor it a bit more. And so it's something oratorial. If I was trying to do something like that in writing, I guess it would just be a repetition thing, or, you know, it's just a matter of slowing down and repeating Winnipeg, Winnipeg, yeah. Winnipeg. But to do it visually is more pleasing to me. Besides, I'm more of a filmmaker than a writer.
But also, I should point out that your title cards have become increasingly shorter over the course of your films. And in fact, one thing I've always wanted to ask you about is the notion of using one word with an exclamation mark as the title card.
Yeah.
It certainly grabs your attention.
It's to that save time. I've decided, I think I'm right too, that if you just flash the card on, it kind of stays on the viewer's retina long after it's gone. Mm-hmm. So you can flash the card on, then go back to the plot, and then people can read the title card as it persists in their memory, or as it's just fading off their retinas a little bit. So it doesn't, you know, longer intertitle cards take up too much time and really slow down momentum. So once you've built up some momentum, but you still want to have title cards, it's important to keep them short. I just use them as spice, or maybe just to tap any ambiguity out of the scene and just tap the direction, tap everyone into the same direction of understanding what's going on. So they're kind of just there to mix things up. Also, it's kind of fun, and now we're speaking of just of the small handful of silent movies I've made, to go back to the days when silent film was an international distributor's dream, where you could just cut out English title cards and put in Spanish ones or German ones or French ones. And so I've been able to do that on these silent movies. It's really fun.
Huh. I'm wondering if you've even thought of what they did in the early sound days, where they had an actor basically do a scene in about 8 different languages so that they could distribute this.
Yeah.
All over the course. I mean, maybe you could do this for if you were to advance further beyond your 20s and 30s emphasis, you could probably, I don't know if you thought of something like that.
Well, I did have kind of interlocutors or explicators narrating a Brand Upon the Brain, the way early silent film did have live narrators come out and just to explain to frightened audience what a close-up is. You know, don't worry, the face is not so giant, it is a close-up now, you know, or she is looking for her lover out the window, you know, just little things to explain. I remember Luis Buñuel describing these things as childhood experiences watching movies, and I was really charmed by them. And I just wanted to have a narrator like that, an explicator of some sort in Brand Upon the Brain.
I'm curious, in the documentary of Twilights of the Ice Nymphs, there is a considerable amount of depiction of you doing all these storyboards and all these plans.
Mm-hmm.
There are notebook sections in this My Winnipeg book, but the sense I get based off of your 2-3 camera coverage, your quickness, the expediency of your editing, that perhaps it's not as planned as vigorously as it used to be.
No, I've ditched all that planning. Yeah. Now I just like to show up on set. I just learned, right around the time I threw my tripod away, I learned that I was getting far better stuff just by going in kind of terrified in the morning, armed with cameras, and just trying to, you know, shoot as much as possible and just try to be in the moment and just find things. And just, it always turned out better than if I tried to storyboard it or anything like that.
But so I'm curious why it took so long for you to realize that just having an intuitive grasp of just madness here, you know, that this worked better than just having everything planned.
Well, I'd seen other Canadian filmmakers with similar levels of experience go in and just try to capture things without any organization, and their movies were really bad. So it seemed to me that the more I planned, the more I bolted down the camera and composed elements within the frame, the better my chances were of producing something watchable. But once I really sort of felt I'd achieved all I could with that, with the movie Careful, I don't know, it's, thank God I do a lot of short movies. I just do them to keep the rust off my eyeball. And so somewhere during some of the shorts, I just started messing around with handheld camera, and I discovered that I was finding far more interesting stuff for the kind of movies I'm making. You know, not every film, thank God, is like these things, but for the kind of melodramatic moments and heightened visual experiences and freedom in editing that this kind of shooting style gives, I couldn't be more thrilled.
I'm curious for a feature, if it's a scenario where it moves so fast because you never know if this may either be your last feature or your last feature in a while, that you need to go ahead and cram as many ideas into it as you can, because this may be the last possible moment, this last capsule, because you never know how the funding is going to come into being, and you've had some really unusual ways of financing your films. And
they're getting stranger and stranger. Lately, I've been selling off parts to people.
but for
$800, you can be an extra in one of my movies.
But this notion, I guess, it seems to me that there have been more ideas in your features after, I think, The Heart of the World.
Yeah.
Onward, at that point, probably from, like, Dracula onward, suddenly you see just this complete obsessiveness with cramming far more into it. It's not just the editing. I think it's just conceptually, there's just far more in these later films. And
I really try to cram things in. Yeah, Gimli Hospital's pretty slender, but it's maybe gotten more atmosphere, but it's a pretty rudimentary story. And then I started to try to cram things in right away with subsequent films, but it was this access to micromontage within the actual storytelling, rather than just an aside or a little detour into an energizing interlude or anything. But I actually try to use micromontage to advance the plot and things like that. So it enables me to cram lots of things in. Sometimes I wonder if I am making things too baroque, and maybe I should just go back to something incredibly simple, you know, a 70-minute long simple little thing. But then you're just really asking your actors to carry, you know, to carry off maybe a something closer to a pitch-perfect performance or something like that. If I just like to take out insurance policies against possible collapses on any front. So if for some reason I mishandle the actors, it's nice just to have a lot of distracting ideas going on. And if
it's a kind of insurance policy against perhaps, quote, bad acting, or just it's sheer.
Yeah. Well, I prefer to call it bad directing, because a lot of my actors are really good. But they all seem to sort of find the same level, the good ones and the bad ones in my movies. Possibly because the visual language just puts them all on the same playing field. Sometimes the dialogue does too. George Toles, who writes all my dialogue, has such a fantastic ear for mannered musical dialogue, and so it's almost impossible for even, you know, a legendary naturalist like Meryl Streep couldn't even say these lines naturally, you know. So she would be put in the same kind of mannered universe as some of the, you know, Winnipeg Dinner Theater performers I like to use. And it's a great unifying force that can't be resisted. And then the way I shoot each and every person kind of unites them as well. So it enables me to cast people just if I want to sleep with them, or if they're really talented,
yeah.
Or if I don't know, I'm still waiting for this to happen, or if they're both.
Yeah. But in Winnipeg, you have a smaller acting supply. Surely the word will get out that there's the Guy Winnipeg casting couch, if that's that's really the case.
I've never used one, actually. Oh, okay. I'll go on record as saying.
Okay, that's good.
I should have, maybe.
I'm curious if you track the amount of times, say, an idea repeats itself. Like, for example, there's the hockey locker room in Cowards that is also in My Winnipeg. And I'm curious if you are concerned about, like, oh, gee, shit, I went ahead and did this before, or if you don't care.
I'm not likely to put in a hockey locker room a third time, or if I do, it'll be meatier. You know, it's something just tossed
off. Sausagier, yeah.
Yeah, that's right. more chorizo. It's something I think I just did one or two shots of it in My Winnipeg, but the locker room is an important place. It's one of the two places I grew up in my childhood, the other being my mom and aunt's beauty salon. So it's just this odd dichotomy, this masculine and feminine split right down the middle of my haunts. In both cases I was doing a species of autobiography, you know, pretty fractured, pretty cubist. So I spend a bit more time in the locker room in Cowards Bend the Knee. I probably basically just threw away in both movies the potential of the locker room. So maybe I could do it one more time, but I would do it properly next time and really, really make something central to it, because I spent a lot of time in the locker rooms as a kid, and I haven't even begun to scratch the surface of the powers, reigning in those places.
A whole film set in the locker room, then.
Yeah, well,
like a feature. You need like a 3-hour locker room movie. That's what you need.
Maybe. I'm really beginning to favor short features. So, my goal, and I reached it at least with the live performances of My Winnipeg and Brand Upon the Brain, is to get zero walkouts on a movie, you know, just to actually, you want to entertain everybody. And then my goal beyond that is to make people laugh and cry simultaneously. But that one's impossible, perhaps. But at least I don't like punishing audiences that much. I know this sounds very Philistine, but it's important to me. But more important to me is, you know, getting a movie out that I'm proud of and on my terms and all that stuff.
I'm also curious about walking. There's a lot of walking in this film, but it also begs to mind, well, I wonder how much of the ideas you come up with by walking. And since, of course, you have the cold 6 months out of the year in Winnipeg, this is an obstacle to walking and thinking and coming up with ideas.
Well, you know what? It's not that cold in Winnipeg. It is cold. It's the coldest city in North America, and it's quite often minus 45 in the winter. But that just means putting on one extra sweater and a really good hat, or maybe a balaclava, you know, something that covers your whole face, a ski mask or something like that. And I used to like walking my dog, who's in the movie, Spanky. Yeah. And this sort of gets us back to books, because some of my favorite books have been, you know, walking literature. Not so much the flaneur tradition of urban walks, but I like the rural ones. Robert Walser from Switzerland.
Not a Guy Debord fan.
No, but Jean-Jacques Rousseau, and then Rings of Saturn with W.G. Sebald, Max. I love that book, and just the idea, and I realized that I was daydreaming about the movie a lot while walking. Walking is just so much better than driving or bike riding for the quality of daydreams. Sometimes they tip you into some sort of graveyard spiral of melancholy, but they always seem to tip me into the past and then leave me trying to figure out where I am in the great flow of time and how much time I might have left and what I should do with it. And then I go back and think of the past again. And I just zigzag slowly and melancholically across my own past and do sort of a roll call of my regrets and things like that, and check on the dog now and then, and just keep walking. And then you tend to see things better too when you're walking. You know, you're not looking, you're not hurtling through space in a car. You see tiny little things and you hear things better. So even though the movie's set in a train and has very little walking in it compared to the kind of connective tissue of this train, rattling train, because I'm enchanted by trains too, because they have a nice sort of daydreamy atmosphere or conducive to reverie. I just really like it. I guess the walking gave me the courage to put the movie together more like a walking book, more like Confessions or Rings of Saturn or even the crazily digressive Robert Walser. I'm nowhere, you know, I'm not saying I'm as good as these people, you know, it would be blasphemy to say so, but I was inspired by, really thrilled by those books and just, they gave me the courage to steal their, attitude. And then I know whenever I try to steal something, it just becomes something else anyway, and I'll never be guilty of theft. But, I just sort of set out the door every day pretending to be Sebald and, you know,
taking photographs and putting them in the middle of your collages.
Yeah, exactly. No, it took lots of photographs. And in the first book of mine that came out, which was my diaries, they did have little Sebaldian uncaptioned photographs throughout. It kind of felt nice.
Conceptually speaking, is there a difference between coming up with an idea when you were walking and coming up with an idea when you were lying in bed?
I hate it when I get ideas in bed because you have to turn on the light and then write them down in a notepad. I hate those wired up evenings. I don't get many ideas in bed. I go to bed to sleep. I'm asleep within seconds usually. I can sleep anywhere. It's something, I don't know, I picked that habit up in undergrad years. I used to sleep in the hallways of my university, right on the floor while students stepped over me. And then as a house painter, I would sleep on tops of ladders. I rested my head against a power line and took a nap once.
But certainly dreams have got to be dreams a are nagging huge. Influence.
Yeah, well,
maybe you need to walk to understand the dreams. I don't know.
Yeah, well, you know, the more contemplation you can do, the more the really apparently disparate parts of your life start fitting together into something like literature. And you start finding themes and echoes in your own lamentations, your own existence. And you realize that you're put together like a piece of art, maybe not a beautiful piece of art, but you know, there's something in there that's, you begin to boil your own self down the way repetition through retellings around campfires have boiled down Bible stories and and fairy tales. If you just think about your place and time long enough, you begin to boil down your own story into something like a folktale.
But what's interesting is that you're thinking about your time and place now, and you're going back to essentially 40 years ago. So 30 to 40 years ago, roughly.
Yeah.
And so it seems to me as if you're having a bit of time travel, perhaps, in your peregrinations and your...
For me, all past and present exist simultaneously. And when I read that that's Faulkner's big, you know, belief, I just thought, all right, you know, it's... Yeah, a corroboration, you know, with the great, and it just makes sense when you're trying to get down the really random spillage of your thoughts and emotions and everything. You know, past and present are simultaneous and equally unreliably remembered. And as far as actual facts go, but like I say, those things don't really matter a whole lot when you're talking about emotions anyway.
Then what of the future? Do you not even think about the future at all?
I try not to. It's so grim. But
grim, why?
No, just because I've done so little planning in my life, I think I know how it's going to play out. It's not pretty.
What, you're certain of this? You can't be certain of anything.
I'm not certain.
No matter how certain. Old you get, you can't be certain of anything.
I do think of the future a bit more, but it's something new to me. I've never been very good at planning. I've lived mostly in the present, which means the present and the past, because they're the same thing. The future is something that was always vague and sketchy and I find suddenly in short supply. It seemed like there was an infinite supply of it, and now I'm just turning 50. It's very arbitrary, but it's suddenly made me realize it's not in, you know,
you can't
an
commit.
Infinite bolt of fabric. You know, it's something that I should spend wisely, and I'm not used to thinking or planning out.
Yeah.
I'm used to studying closely and tasting and savoring things that have already happened or are happening now. But I've been lousy at. I've been no, great planner or. I don't, you know, save up or anything.
You essentially can't commit to being either an optimist or a pessimist because you just have no view of the future. It's just a big blank, basically.
I've always been vaguely optimistic and always assumed that I was, and I seem to be improving the quality of my life each year, so it just, I seem to be, and then I, the old mathematician in me just projected that ray off into infinity and that things would just get better and better. And by the time I was 100, they'd be perfect. I realize now that in all of our trajectories, we're not riding straight as an arrow rays off into infinity. We're riding parabolas that are mostly downside. But I don't mean to sound so gloomy or pessimistic. I'm just being realistic.
You'd be cheery about this inevitability, you know.
I'm looking forward to the walking decay.
Gotcha. Well, Guy, thanks so much for taking the time. It was a pleasure chatting with you.
great to end on that cheery
exactly.
note.
Exactly.
Thank you.
Well, they say you're having an affair. You're living it up. Think you will play, yeah. And I know there's something in the air. Are you giving it up? Do you like to share? It's the same.